Let's go ahead and pray as we begin this morning. Fathers, I mean, just we think of our recent time in Acts, and we see that the winds blow where you designed them to blow, but you are our sovereign God. Many of us have been ill. We have experienced a weakness in our flesh. One of our brothers has been in a tragic plane crash. It's been a bit of a crazy couple weeks for families in our church, but we are glad to be together on the Lord's Day to worship and praise you. And we want to think about your people Israel, their history, and their present existence today. In Jesus' name we pray. Amen. So again, high level, we're thinking about the sixth commandment, honor your father and mother. The fifth commandment, honor your father and mother. And that speaks to authorities. And so we looked at family, parents with children. We looked at husbands and wives. We looked at the family. We've been thinking about civil government authorities. And the civil government is God's minister of justice. And how do they minister justice? Well, they legislate wisely. And then they punish transgressions with the sword. And then it justly bears the sword to defend the life and property of its citizens. So we've dived into each of these aspects of government's responsibilities and how they exercise and minister justice. We've been thinking about foreign relationships, foreign policy, how we interact with other nations. And if we're going to think about these things, we have to think about Israel. So that's what we're going to think about this morning. So first let's do, So this was maybe less top of the news channel this week as it was maybe last week when I was planning to teach this, but we have heard recent news about our allies to the north, Canada and south, Mexico, right? The threat of tariffs was happening, right?
We started it.
We're going to threaten you with tariffs because we wanted to get what in return? Border security, reduction in terms of illegal drugs coming into the country, things of that nature. Okay. J.D. Vance went to Europe and he gave some interesting talks on AI and how America wanted to be at the forefront of exercising AI and using it well. What about other allies around the world? So 2 weeks ago, the king of Jordan, his name is Abdullah II, he said to President Trump, he was visiting, "I truly believe, with all the challenges that we have in the Middle East, that I finally see somebody that can take us across the finish line to bring stability, peace, and prosperity to all of us in the region." So here's Jordan hoping for peace in the Middle East. There's not been peace for centuries. Ongoing conflicts between people groups in this region of the world. What should we think about Israel? What should we think about Palestine? What should we think about the Arab nations? How would we relate to them? That's what we want to think about this morning. But as I just said, this has been going on for centuries, so we need to do a little bit of history overview. Of course, God created the planet. He created Earth. Adam and Eve were dwelling there first. Then others would dwell in the various lands, roughly in the Middle Eastern region, right, is where we think the origins of humankind began. The flood happens, and then eventually you learn of the Canaanites who are dwelling in the land. And then there's this promise to Abraham. It's worth reading, so let's all turn to Genesis 15. Would someone like to read Genesis 15, verses 18 to 21?
On that day, the Lord made a covenant with Abram, saying, "To your offspring I give this land from the river of Egypt to the great river, the river Euphrates, the land of Kenites, the Kenizzites, the Kadamites, Cadmonites, the Hittites, the Perizzites, the Rephaim, the Amorites, the Canaanites, the Girgashites, and the Jebusites."
Yes. So here's the initial promise that God's making to Abraham. Right? And he had told him, pick up your household, leave Ur, travel to this land that I'm going to show you. And there's this unfolding revelation for Abraham where God's going to reveal to him, what is that land? And he's saying, look, this land, it's going to stretch from this border to this border, these great rivers. This promise is reiterated on the land in chapter 17. So this promise to Abraham is coming somewhere in the 21 to 1600s, somewhere in that region. Now, we of course know what happens to Abraham and his descendants. They end up going into Egypt in captivity. They get into slavery. They're taken out into the wilderness. There's this promise that they're going to come back to this land. And we see, if we would turn to Joshua, chapters 1 and 2. Well, chapter 1. Joshua chapter 1. So I'm going to read verses 2 to 6. Linus, do you want to read Joshua chapter 1, verses 2 to 6?
Joshua 1?
Yeah.
Moses, my servant, is dead. Now therefore arise and go over this Jordan, you and all this people, into the land that I am giving to them, to the people of Israel. Every place that the sole of your foot will tread upon, I have given to you, just as I promised to Moses. From the wilderness to this Lebanon, as far as the river Euphrates, all the land of the Hittites, to the great sea, toward the going down of the sun, shall be your territory. No man shall be able to stand before you all the days of your life. Just as I was with Moses, so I will be with you. I will not leave you or forsake you. Be strong and courageous, for you shall cause this people to inherit the land that I swore to their fathers to give.
So God made a promise. He's coming through on his promise now with Joshua. He's going to be with the next leader to bring them into the land that he had promised them. So you could say there's this initial fulfillment, and yet we see, as we look at the story that goes forward, it's only a partial fulfillment. Because they lay hold of some of the land, they overcome some of the peoples in the land, but not all of them. As the story continues to unfold, the land continues to expand as David becomes king, and he's putting up primarily the Philistines. Solomon takes reign. The land is expanding even more, and there are some who would understand that Solomon's reign is from the river in Egypt to the great river in Euphrates. Some would take that interpretation, not everybody, but for a time, that there is, again, a initial fulfillment of this land. Does it last? No, it doesn't. The land falls apart under the division between the north and the south kingdom. This proceeds to years of Israel experiencing threats at the hand of other foreign nations, and eventually coming under the Assyrians and being taken out of the land, coming under the rule of the Babylonians under Nebuchadnezzar. The Persians then rule over the land when Cyrus comes in the 530s. Eventually the Greeks, Alexander the Great, is going to go and he's going to conquer much of the region. And then we know in about 167 was the Maccabean Revolt. And we have that in extra biblical history written for us. That the Maccabees revolted and Israel became free in 142 BC. For about 80 years, they were free in the land until Pompey came in with the Romans and conquered them. And the Roman Empire is expanding and building. That Roman Empire rules and reigns until 330 BC when the Byzantine Empire takes over. And then you have the Muslims growing in about the middle of the 600s. They come and take over Jerusalem and part of the land. And then you have this back and forth between Christians and Muslims trying to conquer Jerusalem, parts of the land. The Crusades take place. Eventually the Ottoman Empire develops in 1517 AD. And that lasts 400 years until the British take over the land of Israel in 1917, around World War I. And then in 1948, Israel becomes an independent nation of its own. And from then until now, there has been ongoing conflict between Israel, people within the land, and their neighbors. And one thing that Wayne Grudem says, right, we have this idea of Palestine as a, you know, as a separate area, separate nation. You look at that history, Palestine has never actually existed in any of that time as its own separate nation in this land. So when Palestinians come and want to say, we're a nation, we're in this land, that's not what the history records show us. Okay, so 1948, Israel became an independent nation. That's where we're going to pick up and dive into more of the details. So the events of World War I or World War II take place and the Holocaust. The Jews are scattered around the world, and there's this resolve to bring them back to the land after the Second World War. And so Israel forms as an independent nation. They declared their independence on the precedent of the 1917 Balfour Declaration. I'll read that for us. So the Balfour Declaration says, His Majesty's government view with favor the establishment in Palestine. And I don't know where, I don't know the origination of Palestine. Is that what that?
Yeah.
Oh, okay. Interesting. Okay. So in Palestine, of a national home for the Jewish people, and will use their best endeavors to facilitate the achievement of this object. It being clearly understood that nothing shall be done which may prejudice the civil and religious rights of existing non-Jewish communities in Palestine, or the rights and political status enjoyed by Jews in any other country. So Israel declares their independence. Many come back to this land and they settle there. Not many Jews settle there. Of course, we could ask all sorts of questions of Jews of what lineage and how to, you know, what ethnicities, but they claim and profess to be Jews. So, now, technically, the United Nations wanted to establish how many nations?
Two.
Yep. Israel and Palestine. Yep. Well, what happened? Well, Palestine basically said no, right? No, we're not going to do that. They offered clear boundaries, shared land, shared access to Jerusalem. The Arabs refused to cooperate. They refused to agree. So ongoing military and violent activity took place, and that's what we're going to look at next. So May 15th, 1948, five Arab nations around Israel attacked Egypt, Syria, Jordan, Lebanon, and Iraq. So Israel goes on the offensive, and they respond, and they win this war. So May 11th, 1949, so almost a year later, the ceasefire happens, and Israel enters into the UN. Now, them entering into the UN is recognition by all the other countries who are part of the UN that they exist as a sovereign nation with, you could say, rights to their territory and so on and so forth. Now, this engagement means peoples moving around. So you have Jews moving out of Arab nations into Israel. You have Arabs moving out of Israel into other Arab nations. So the number of Arabs that moved out of Israel was 750,000 Palestinians. Now Israel received Jews who were refugees from other nations into their country. They became citizens. They assimilated them. You could say they were, in a sense, as we talked about, they were foreigners who became sojourners, even though they shared the religion and ethnicity of Judaism, right? They were foreign-born. They were welcomed into citizenship. The same thing did not happen in the Arab nations. So right, Palestinians being pushed out of Israel, going into other Arab nations, they were not received as full citizens. Why do you think that was? So thinking that they were in the land of Israel, they had taken on Jewish...
people throughout history have hated Jews.
Okay.
That's been going on for centuries.
So you're thinking about Jews that were living in Arab nations. Is that what you're
right.
thinking about? Okay, I'm thinking about the Palestinians that got pushed out of Israel, right, because of the conflict. They're Arabs by ethnicity and values and culture. I'm not the Jews. I get the anti-Semitism. Yeah. Which is what Jews experienced if they stayed in Arab nations. Does that make sense? Jews who stayed in Arab nations were treated wrongly and oppressed. They weren't given the same citizenship as others in the country.
Yeah. They wanted to push the Palestinians back to that area so they could yes. pressure on Israel in different ways.
Yes. So we now have second or third or fourth generation Palestinians.
Oh, you're saying displaced Palestinians.
Displaced Palestinians, yeah. Put out of Israel.
We're not welcomed into
they weren't Egypt welcomed yet. Into full citizenship.
Jordan,
yes.
Lebanon. Okay.
Because they wanted them to maintain their distinct whatever social cultural status as refugee Palestinians. Even generations down, because we're going to send them back into Israel to get that land. That's been their approach. Does that make sense? All right. So their long-term plan is to conquer Israel. So three regions get established after this initial war, this year-long war. Israel, Gaza Strip, and the West Bank of the Jordan River. All right, go forward about two decades and you have the Six-Day War in June of 1967. So Egypt had done some conflicts, some activity towards Israel. Israel responds to Egypt and Syria. And in that Six-Day War, they take hold of the Sinai Peninsula, the Gaza Strip, the West Bank, East Jerusalem, and the Golan Heights. I think for those of us, we lived during this, these terms mean something to us. We've lived through some of this history. We've heard of these. That was the Six-Day War. The Yom Kippur War happened in 1973. Again, Egypt, Syria, surprise attack to regain that land that they lost during the Six-Day War. So they're trying to get that land back. So then you have the Camp David Accords in 1979. And that ends 30 years of conflict between Israel and Egypt. Creates a relative peace between those two nations. Then you have what's called the First Intifada in 1987. So these are Palestinians living in the West Bank and Gaza, and they rise up against Israel. Right? This is a region within the country of Israel, and they're rising up against them. So you get to the Oslo Accords of 1993, which more or less set up a self-governance for Palestine in the West Bank and Gaza. So giving them governance of that land.
Okay.
Yeah. Yep. And I'm not a history expert. I'm not
Yeah.
So feel free to fill in things that you guys are aware of and know. I'm just trying to give us the general picture of what we see happening over the last century. Okay. So First Intifada happens, this revolt against Israel by Palestinian Arabs. There's peace for a time. Then there's a second intifada starting in 2000 to 2005 is when that one takes place. That provoked Israel to respond by starting to build the barrier, the wall that now exists. Now, Palestine, these Arabs, sort of after that era, you have factions emerging because this is what human beings do. Right, we struggle to remain unified even when we have shared ethnicity or shared culture. Even Christians, right, we struggle to do this. So no surprise, the Palestinian Arabs start to break off into different factions. You have Fatah and Hamas, those groups forming. And so they're sort of fighting with each other for rule of that self-governance of those regions. So in 2014, then there's a clash between Hamas and Israel during the summer, going back and forth. In March 2018, there's another clash between the Israeli Defense Group and the Palestinians. And here, that factionalism between Fatah and Hamas, they were kind of getting along for a while, but now they diverge again. And so Fatah takes hold of the West Bank, and Hamas takes control down in Gaza. May of 2021, again, you have protests and skirmishes, rocket artillery strikes. And then October 7th, 2023, the most recent conflict, Hamas attacked Israel. And that lasted really up until last month when, from what I understand, the U.S. and Egypt have negotiated a ceasefire and are seeking to bring about an end to this conflict. All right, so Hamas attacks, Israel responds by declaring war. The IDF seizes the Gaza region. They also moved against Lebanon in the north because Hezbollah was seeking to attack from Lebanon, doing skirmishes there. Iran attacked Israel during this time. They attacked U.S. bases as well. And then we get to the ceasefire in January of 2025. So hostages are being released now. Aid is coming in to help people. Troops are being withdrawn. Now, whatever you think about the conflict and who is at fault, and probably both sides, you know, if there's anything like my two children in conflict that I come and seek to work through with them, they're both bringing something to the table here. There's a hard reality that 90% of the Gazan population has been displaced. I mean, these are human image bearers. There's an aspect that we have to figure out, where do these people go? How are they cared for? What's next for them? Where do they settle? How do you create a space for Israel, a space for them to live? And some have questioned, even though Israel responds strongly and, you know, seems to be winning and keeping their sovereignty, and they've destroyed a number of Hamas leaders in the Gaza region, has that just radicalized others to come and take up arms and continue to fight against them? So it's a bit of the just kind of quick run through the history. Anything folks would add that you're aware of or questions you have? Yeah.
They are against a lot of Hamas. And I know Iran is the one that's supplying Hamas and Hezbollah. Mm. You know, so, you know, Israel has to defend themselves. Concerning a Palestine whole, Arabs have all this country, whereas Israel only has a small piece of the country. So there's always been an opportunity. And there was opportunity for them, and when they took over the West Bank and, you know, the Gaza Strip, they could have, Israel gave them supplies and helped them build up, left supplies there for schools, and instead they drove tunnels underneath. And so a lot of those people have been radicalized, you know, have been influenced by that leadership. So, but even the other Arab countries are having conflict with them.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah, go ahead.
I think there's one other important point to remember that we, it's really hard to keep track of, but Hezbollah and Lebanon are controlled, as is Iran, by Shiite Muslims. It's a sect of religion that's completely different from the Sunni Muslims that all the rest are controlled by it, and these two groups are hating each other, sort of like the Catholics and the Protestants. So they're very different. I mean, the Sunnis have great difficulty cooperating with the Shiites, and, you know, want to maintain control of the Arab coalition rather than cede any of that control to Iran and the Shiites. So. It just adds another factor, but the Shiites and Hezbollah attacked Israel at the same time that the Sunnis and Hamas attacked from the south. So they're kind of getting attacked from both sides.
Yeah. Yep.
They all hate the Jews.
So let's think about this: Israel and the Arabs, and some Arabs have remained in Israel. So not all left, right? They are citizens. They get to vote. Back in 2009, they held 12 of the 120 seats in the Knesset, which is the Israel parliament. So Arabs in the land were allowed to participate in the governance of the land. They were, you could say they had become sojourners to the extent that they had assimilated and were participating in the life and welfare of their country. There happens to be, at that time, there was a Christian Arab of Lebanese descent who was on the Israeli Supreme Court. You know, some of these Arab peoples by ethnicity have been Christians in the historical sense for generations. They're not always Muslims. Some of them surprisingly, Arabs have served as generals in Israel's army. Now they were, so you could say in some sense, Arabs have been welcomed in the land to a degree. But the Jews, again, have been forced out of Arab lands. They've been oppressed, anti-Semitism. And to what Liz was just saying, think about comparing Israel to Arab and nations. And did I give you guys the chart there that shows the, yeah. So on page 2, compare the land that Israel has versus the Arab nations. Israel is 8,522 square miles. The Arab nations combined have 2.45 million square miles. And the Arabs want to fight over Gaza and the West Bank, these small regions to live in, when there's plenty of opportunity and land for them to go and live in and dwell, and they could seek their prosperity elsewhere. And you, yeah, go ahead, guy.
Those areas, though, aren't inconsequential. I mean,
right.
Gaza, not so much. I mean, they were those 5 Philistine cities in the past, but I mean, the West Bank, that includes Bethlehem and, you know, Nazareth. And, you know, these are places you've heard of. The tomb of Abraham, the tomb of Jacob, and these are important historical sites. This is not some off in a corner place. It's the middle of everything. Mm-hmm. So that's why they're so fired.
Yeah. Yep.
And, you know, Jerusalem in particular, the Arabs say that was where Muhammad made his
right.
night voyage to see God. So, you know, it's a holy site.
Yeah.
There, it's a holy site, obviously, for the Jews.
The Jews.
That's where their temple was, and guess what? It's where Christ was crucified. So it's a big deal. So.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. But when you look at the land comparisons in terms of are people actually going to live somewhere, there's much more land available for Arabs to go and live in other places. And we could work towards a way where these historically meaningful sites, Arabs could have access to them. There's a possibility for that, is what we're trying to say. Because that doesn't mean as much for daily life, if you will.
They have access to those sites than the Jews.
They do, yeah.
Because they're under control of
right. You look at the population. The Arab nations have 473 plus million. Israelites are 9.8 million. That's a big difference. So the Arab nations would include Egypt, Saudi Arabia, Yemen, Oman, United Arab Emirates, Qatar, Kuwait, Iraq, Jordan, Syria, Iran. So when you look at, I mean, the land of Israel is 0.35% the size of the Arabian nations. So if we're looking at a football field, Israel is 1.6 feet long, so that's half of a yard in football, the whole width of the field, and the rest of the land is the Arab nations. That's what Israel has, like a half of a yard on a football field. Arab has everything else. Now, as Guy's saying, there's historical reasons why that half a yard is of significance to both Jews and Christians and Muslims.
Pastor?
Yeah.
Also, not just historical, but the future, I would imagine, a lot of them also know the promised land, right? Aren't aware of what God's promised Israel in the future.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and we'll get to talking about that. Yeah. So if you think of Arab nations, and if we were to fill the Viking stadium, there would be about 1,500 Israelites and 71,500 Arabs in the stadium. That's the difference in population. And I didn't try to figure out what section of the stadium, you know, 1,500 people would say, but it's a little sliver compared to the rest of the stadium, right? So let's go back and review our just war theory. So the way that the Arabs have often related to Israel is with violence, terrorism, suicide bombings, especially during the Second Intifada in the mid to early 2000s. So the Arabs would attack civilians on buses. They would go to marketplaces. They would fire rockets from civilian areas. They would store munitions in people's homes. From 2000 to 2003 in July, there were 73 attacks. Now, as we think about just war theory, what's some of our principles, right? The civil state has the responsibility to protect its citizens' life and property. That's one of its God-given responsibilities. It means both being reactive, responding to people who attack, as well as being proactive or preemptive to prevent attacks. So they got to collect intelligence information, they need to have weaponry, they need to have a defense system. Now, some of our criteria for just war, I'm just going to read through these real quick. So there needs to be just cause. What's the moral ground for going to war? There needs to be a competent authority. Who declares the war? It needs to be comparative justice. Does the nation uphold good conduct and motives in contrast to a morally wrong nation? We can go, if you need these, they're on the website. You can go back to past classes to find this. There needs to be right intention. What's the purpose for the war? Is this a last resort? What other means of peacekeeping have been exhausted? You're going to think about probability of success. Are we going to win this war if we engage in it? Or proportionality of projected results. Will the positive outcomes outweigh the negative costs of going to war? And then a right spirit. Is the war undertaken with great reluctance and sorrow at the harm that will come rather than simply with a delight in war? Well, that's do you go to war or not? Then there's, if you say yes, you think through those questions and you say yes, then how do you go to war? Well, a just war requires just means of war. So proportionality in the use of force. Can no greater destruction be caused than is needed to win the war? Or discrimination between combatants and non-combatants? You want to avoid evil means. How are captured or defeated enemies treated? What sort of weapons are used? And then good faith. Is the ultimate goal peace and restoration with the attacking nation, or are you trying to destroy them? That's a review of just war theory. So given those principles, talk at your table about the interaction between Israel and the Arabs and talk about that. Perhaps in your conversation you realize that as great in principle as just war theory sounds, it's more complex when you're trying to work it out. And
well, it's also based on biblical principles.
It is.
And if you don't adhere to those biblical principles, you're not likely to endorse just war.
Right. Yep. as we observe. Yeah. So what did Israel do in the 2000s? The second Intifada was taking place. They decided to build a wall. That wall is 62% complete. It stretches 440 miles. It runs roughly along the 1949 Armistice Green Line, way back in that initial conflict after Israel declared independence, and then that war took place for a year. In some regions, there are concrete walls. They're upwards of 30 feet high. In other areas, there's a fence system. There's multiple layers. There's like the road, and then there's like sand tracks so that they can do tracking, and then there are like ditches, and then there are multiple layers of types of fencing. Anti-vehicle ditches. There are patrol roads on both sides. Now, some of the walls go through cities. Some of the walls have cut off cities. They've cut off regions that are important, access to resources. So Israel built a wall. And I mentioned that there was 73 attacks in those 3 years. After the wall was built, there were 12 attacks in the next 3 years. And so Israel says, look, building a barrier had an effect on reducing the attacks from Palestine. Or did the IDF just get better at preventing attacks?
Because they have a wall.
It's like, you can't do this. There's no research study that you can do to prove causation in a simulation.
It doesn't prove tunneling efforts.
Proves tunneling efforts, yeah. Now, Arabs would be concerned that some of their Palestinian towns are actually entirely encircled by parts of the wall. Some of them are cut off from others by the wall. That's real. There's decreased mobility, so it takes increased time for them to engage transportation to get from point A to point B. There are Christians, Arab Christians in some of these regions, and they want to get to their church, and they can't get there easily because they have to go through checkpoints. Or maybe they need to get to medical services, or they need to get to other things. The more security checkpoints there are, the longer it takes for the IDF to have to work through as people are moving around. Those are true realities. They might be realities that you have to live with because of the circumstances. So of course there's fighting over the positioning of this fence and this wall. So let's think a little bit about Gaza, the Gaza Strip. This is land down in the southwest corner of Israel. It runs along the Mediterranean Sea. It's about 25 miles long and varies between 4 and 7.5 miles wide. It's about 140 square miles. The population is a little over 2+ million. Now, back in 1947, the original plan was that this strip was to be part of the Arab nation, right? Two nations, Israel, the Arab nation of Palestine. This was supposed to be part of that. And the Egyptians controlled it. And remember, Israel conquered it in the Six-Day War in 1967. And so they conquer it, and Jews go and they settle there. They build homes, they build farms in this region. Now, in 2005, as a part of the call for peace, that second Intifada era, Israel agreed to withdraw and pull themselves out. So at that time, there were 21 Jewish settlements, roughly 8,000 Israelis living in this Gaza region. Now, why did they draw out? Peace. Because they agreed to make peace. Is that what they got? No. Iran backed a terrorism base 50 miles from Tel Aviv. Hamas attacked with rocket launches from Gaza. And the attacks increased tenfold after this land was given back to the Palestinians in Gaza to have self-governance. Netanyahu was the president at the time, and he called this a double war crime, attacking citizens while hiding from behind citizens. That's how the Arabs engaged in unjust warfare. They used homes, schools, mosques to store materials and to launch attacks. Now, how did Israel respond to the increase in Hamas attacks? Well, some of the wall had, so they started building the wall, started building up that defense, but they focused on military targets as best as they could. And when they had to attack regions where civilians were living, they notified them ahead of time with mailers, text messages, announcements over broad speakers, saying, leave this area, we're going to attack. They're trying to be just. And some of you say, like, who tells your enemy that you're about to attack a certain region, right? Like, that was a bit of a confidence, you could say, in Israel's part, that they think they could attack. So Israel is trying to do this, and the UN comes and says that Israel is wrong for what they're doing. And Israel, and the UN says nothing about the 12,000 missiles that were launched into Israel. But Israel gets condemned for war crimes. Now, Gaza, of course, was the site of the most recent conflict. What's the problem and the solution to this Arab-Israeli conflict? What's the root of the conflict? Is it about shared resources? Is it about the amount of land? Is it about population? At that table, you guys had the answer to this question. What's the root of the problem? The very existence of Israel. The fact that these Jews are breathing and living. That's the root of the conflict. The Arabs want to destroy the Jews and wipe them off the face of the earth. None of them left. That's the root of the problem. This is not cousins fighting over toys, over who gets to play with the toy. This is Cain and Abel. This is, I hate you with such vengeance that I want you destroyed. This is bitterness at a social, at a broader social level, not just in an individual. The Palestinian Arabs reject the very existence of Israel. Their desire is to destroy Israel. Now, Israel is not without fault. It's not as if they're the brother who has no guilt. They haven't poked them, if you will, or they haven't done things that are wrong. But you can't negotiate or seek to make peace with somebody who doesn't want you to continue to exist, who wants to see your blood spilled all across the ground and wants to rejoice in that. So Wayne Grudem says this on negotiations. What is the solution to the current conflict? As long as the Palestinian Arab leaders and the surrounding Arab nations insist that their goal is the total destruction of Israel, and as long as they continue to insist that their Israel has no right to exist as a nation, I see no point in negotiation between Israel and the Palestinians. There's no intermediate bargaining point between existing and not existing as a nation. Israel is not going to give up its right to exist or its right to defend itself, nor do I think it should ever give up those things. Therefore, until the most basic Palestinian position changes from this fundamental commitment, the only way to maintain a reasonable amount of peace in that region is for Israel to maintain a strong military force and to use that force to defend itself when necessary. This seems to me to fit into the description of a just war, because of the fundamental right of the nation to defend itself against an evil enemy who continues to attack and seek to destroy it. End quote from Wayne Grudem. The way you could think about this is to ask the question, what would happen if the Palestinians and the Arabs laid down their arms? There'd be peace. Yeah, what else?
The walls would probably come down.
The walls might come down. Yeah. Religious groups might be able to set up places of their worship in regions that were important and significant. They'd figure out how to do that, knowing that there's a shared heritage and tradition and value. Yeah.
Isn't there an underlying factor where it's a very satanic war, in the sense that Satan does not want the Messiah to come back? And he will come back through Israel, you know, through that time, the second coming. So it just seems like it's such a satanic war that it's more than just, you know, the evilness of men. There's much more to this story, you know, I think. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, certainly anytime a brother is willing to kill a brother, there's sin, depravity in that heart, and then on the spiritual realm, Satan and his forces are at work. And I mean brother because these people share a shared history and lineage. Yeah. But what would happen if Israel laid down their arms? They'd get killed in 60 seconds, you know, if you will. Yeah. So you see the position that they're in. I mean, this isn't, it's not a favorable position. Okay. I don't think we have time to finish the rest of what I have prepared here. This is a good place to pause. So we'll pick this up again next week and continue our discussion there. So any other questions or thoughts? Okay. Thanks.